So we've had incredible bipartisanship behind this enormous fraud, behind the least worthwhile spending of U.S. money. And Robert Gates just doesn't think it's enough.
To understand geopolitics, you must have the freedom to be honest.
The More Freedom Foundation podcast.
Hello, Rob. How are you this week?
Well, Murray, I'm in a pretty bad mood.
Why, what have you done now?
Oh, so much, so much. beyond my petty personal disasters, I've got construction going over my head all day today. And I'm also just really, I feel like we've kind of finally lost Joe Biden.
What's he done? Has he wandered off somewhere and forgot where he's at?
Well, that's certainly always a possibility with our geriatric in chief. But no, I think really, I mean, George W. Bush was a pure creature of the military-industrial complex. He rebelled against his military-industrial complex father by doubling down on the dumber and more violent aspects of that complex. But every president since Rory has tried to get away from the rolling 20-year catastrophe that the U.S. foreign policy establishment has inflicted on the world. Barack Obama tried, you know, desperately with speeches, with the Iran nuclear deal, with his opening to Cuba. Of course, he was eventually, and actually quite quickly, utterly defeated by the military-industrial complex.
And then he was implementing the surge in no time?
Exactly. He was bludgeoned into doing the surge because he was like, well, at least we can withdraw from Iraq. And then he was convinced to turn Syria into a free fire zone for the Islamic State and other jihadists, which then, of course, required the United States to jump right back into Iraq. And, you know, desperately, you know, he finally learned Washington, D.C. well enough that towards the end of his term. He put the Iran nuclear deal in place, but it was never really implemented even before Donald Trump destroyed it. But Obama at least tried. Donald Trump came to power saying a lot of horrible things, let's be clear, but also with a kind of impressive focus on how failed U.S. military efforts had been, perhaps just solely to embarrass the Bush family. But there, you know, there's that clip from the 2015 Republican debate where he's just like, this has been a complete catastrophe. We've wasted trillions of dollars. And for what? You know, we didn't have victory. I mean, he came in part, the reason Donald Trump exists is because of incredibly justified rage at what the U.S. foreign policy establishment, the military-industrial complex has been doing to the world and the U.S. taxpayer for the past 20 years. Of course, he was utterly incapable of any kind of governing action, was a nonstop dumpster fire, and actually that dumpster fire allowed the U.S. military-industrial complex to move from its focus on terrorism, which the people were kind of sick of, but more or less were on board with, to starting wars with Russia and China. That's an explicit policy that was put in place while everybody was focused on how nasty Trump was, called great power competition. And we see the fruits now with the war in Ukraine and the war in Taiwan that Washington, D.C. is desperately trying to build. So Trump was obviously, he said some great things, which Obama was never able to say. Obama did a few things and did a lot of many more horrible things for the military-industrial complex because he felt he had to try and do a few good things, which Trump proceeded to destroy. I mean, the presidents are an element within the U.S. System that still holds on to vestiges of democracy. They are responsible to the American people, and any sane person who spends, you know, a week looking at the world and the U.S. government can tell you that the U.S. foreign policy establishment has screwed up terribly. So with Biden, I had great hopes. This wasn't I mean, Trump was a complete innocent as far as how the world works.
A precious soul.
Yeah, I think Dan Dresner uses toddler in chief language a lot. But frankly, Obama was obviously much better, you know, a constitutional law scholar, had some sense of, you know, how these things are supposed to work, but frankly had very little experience of government before or of Washington, D.C. before he came into office. What we saw by the end of his time in power with his opening to Cuba, with his attempt to make peace with Iran, an Iranian regime that has been desperately trying to make peace with the United States since the 1990s, because he'd learned Washington, D.C. He'd learned that the generals were lying to him after the humiliation of the Afghanistan surge. He'd figured it out. Biden is a guy who knew what was up coming in. He knew Washington, D.C. He was an American president representing the American people. Of course, he's made all kinds of terrible decisions that he's aware of in service to the U.S. military-industrial complex. And at the outset, it really looked like maybe we'd get something different. His heroic, possibly the only decision I can by an American president I can describe as heroic this century, and not possibly, definitely, his heroic withdrawal from Afghanistan, more or less complete ending of the drone war, certainly compared to Bush and Obama and Trump. These were valuable steps forward, and he does have a bunch of people around him who are trying desperately to craft a better approach to things. Of course, there was the disaster in Russia and Ukraine Obama had allowed to start, and Trump had vastly exacerbated, and Biden's hands were tied as to dealing with that. It's like one of the greatest weapon that the military-industrial complex has, that it was given in Ukraine, that it was carefully crafted for it in Ukraine by a lot of Washington, D.C. actors, was an actual real cause, that they really hadn't had since a cause for good defending the Ukrainian people. But that tied Biden's hands and sort of boxed him in and forced him into certain channels. This Israel-Gaza thing has really just... as far as I'm concerned, ended the independent Biden presidency. He gave a speech, I guess it'll be a week or 10 days at the time of this airing, essentially saying Hamas and Putin are the same thing. And it's just, I mean, that is one of the true, probably one of the greatest turning points in the 20th century is not, in fact, 9/11. 9/11, like most of the conflicts of the 1990s, was an after effect of the Cold War. It was, created by a U.S. client state, Saudi Arabia, networks that had been created by the CIA in the 1980s to fight in Afghanistan. It was the true turning point in the 20th century, the point at which the United States said, we're actually gonna take this post-Cold War utopia and we're gonna kill it, is the Axis of Evil speech. In 2002. This was the point at which Afghanistan had largely already been defeated with the help of Iran, or at least was mostly on the way there. If you ever wonder why the United States was able to instantly conquer Afghanistan and then couldn't do anything there for the next 20 years, it's because Iran helped us. Between 9/11 and, they've been desperately trying to get in our good graces since the 90s, and they helped us conquer Afghanistan. And then in January of 2002, George W. Bush came out with the Axis of Evil speech. And the idiocy of that speech was talking about how Iran and Iraq, two countries that are actually, somewhat...
Not the best of friends.
Yeah, well, yes, sworn enemies, vaguely Islamic looking, and to the American public, that's...
And their names sound similar.
Exactly. And then North Korea, just sort of thrown in there as a grab bag. And just the absolute absurdity of putting those people together, because in truth, what the Bush administration was trying to do was create a reason to use U.S. military power and expand U.S. military power. And to do that, they constructed this fantasy that there was some kind of connection between these very disparate entities. At the time of, I'm putting this in a video, but I just, coming up shortly, but just... at the time he made that speech, Iran was, again, this regime that was desperately trying to get in the U.S.'s good graces, had just helped us win in Afghanistan. Iraq was wholly defeated, wholly dependent on, oil for food programs, and was most, if you wanted to defeat Iraq, you basically just needed better ambassadors at the United Nations. Like, there was no threat there. There was no threat from Iran. North Korea, actually, I think it was called the Agreed Framework. It was kind of a Iran nuclear deal of the 90s, except with North Korea. And at that point, North Korea was being effectively bribed not to use the nuclear technology that we knew they had. So Bush's Axis of Evil speech, this sort of idiocy of like, let's create these evils that we can use military against, turned Iraq into a trillion-dollar nightmare, a multi-trillion-dollar nightmare for the U.S. Military, that eventually produced a country that is a protectorate for Iran, which has now finally been convinced that the United States will never treat it with the decency that it has been begging for 30 years. And is not really a regional rival, but if the United States insists on having as many U.S. vulnerable U.S. troops as we do, is a real problem for us. And North Korea, thanks to the Bushies, became a nuclear armed state. So it was cataclysmic failure, and part of the absurdity of that was this desperate urge to throw these disparate elements that had nothing to do with each other, other than trying desperately to survive U.S. aggression, sort of led to these 20 years of failure. Biden's speech a week or two back, a week or 10 days back, claiming that Hamas and Putin are the same thing, is like the Axis of Evil speech on steroids. It is even less logical.
Because I've heard the defense of it is that it's trying to sort of rope in Republicans that aren't so keen on, you know, they support Israel, but they don't really support Ukraine. So they're trying to sort of mix the two together to say this is as important as supporting Israel.
I'm sure that's the rhetorical strategy, but that's, you know, that's how they get you. You know, it's just, oh, gosh, D.C. politics are so crazy that in order to do this good thing, we've got to put forward this absolutely nonsensical rhetorical front. And I really do think it's kind of, for me, it's like this is the end of Joe Biden as any kind of restraining influence on the military industrial complex.
Is your hope for him all lost now?
Yeah, I think it's pretty emphatically crushed. So yeah, not in a great mood.
Okay.
I guess it's probably a testament to my lack of humanity that it's that just sort of utter defeat of the idea of any kind of restraint in U.S. foreign policy that is bothering me more than the piles of dead children we're seeing in Gaza.
At least they're not invading Venezuela, so that's at least one thing.
Yes. So finally, I've been talking about this for a solid year and a half since the second Russia invaded Ukraine, that we absolutely must stop trying to destroy the Venezuelan oil industry, allow the Venezuelans to export oil. I mean, they don't have to export oil to us. They can export oil to other people and just reduce the cost. That is finally happening. There has been a deal for sanctions relief in Venezuela. That's a great thing. The problem, Rory, is the reason it's finally happened after Gaza's invasion of Israel and Israel's, 5x on its way to 10x retribution in terms of dead children is so that it clears the decks for the United States to go to war with Iran.
Oh, so they can replace the oil they're getting from Iran?
Exactly.
Or their partners are getting
exactly.
from Iran?
If we were at all serious about making Putin get less money from oil and gas, then opening up to Iran and Venezuela were what. And, you know, to Biden's credit is, despite the Republican Congress, despite everyone in the foreign policy establishment being against it, he was attempting an opening to Iran. He couldn't put anything on paper. He couldn't do anything. I mean, we've talked about it on this podcast, but he was allowing Iran to sell a great deal of oil and gas to, I'm not sure if it was gas as well, but certainly oil to China. I think that this opening to Venezuela, something that we've dearly hoped for years here on this channel, is probably just or perhaps it's just a warning to Iran, which is saying, look, we're figuring out how to replace you, so you better keep Hezbollah out of this fight in Israel. That is a nice little silver lining there. But
how will they justify a war with Iran, or will it just sort of be like they're in the mood?
Well, what's interesting is that it seems like the gloves are sort of already off. If Hezbollah were to get into it and start, you know, largely attacking Israel, there is a U.S. aircraft carrier now just hanging out in the Mediterranean waiting to be sunk. I have no great faith in the ability of U.S. aircraft carriers, which have not been challenged in a real war since for 80 years, to stand up under any kind of sustained missile barrage. there's a lot of pathways through which we can just be in a war with Iran with absolutely no input from the U.S. people or even the U.S. Congress. Certainly, there's very few people in the Democratic Party and no people in the Republican Party, maybe two or three, like maybe Rand Paul, who would stand in the way of a war with Iran at this point. So yeah, I think it's a very distinct possibility. I'm not saying it's necessarily a likelihood. As ever, we're incredibly reliant on the heroic restraint of the Iranian government. But as the casualties mount in Gaza, they may find themselves less capable of restraining Hezbollah. And if Hezbollah gets into it, Iran's probably going to have to get into it.
Because has there been more skirmishes with Hezbollah?
There have been.
Because isn't it seen as, it's hard to know who exactly won that last war, but isn't it considered Israel didn't exactly win in the last conflict with Hezbollah?
Yes, they did. They were largely seen to be embarrassed in their invasion of Lebanon in 2006. I don't think Israel would send a single troop into Lebanon this time, though. They would just bomb everything.
There's quite a lot of UN peacekeepers there at the moment.
Gosh, really? In southern Lebanon? The details of that escape me at this moment. I wasn't what I prepared for today, Rory. But I think we have sort of done the general scene, so perhaps we should get into what we prepared for today.
Is there anyone that would best be described as the complete opposite of what you believe in and what the American military and government should do?
That would be, I don't think anybody truly, because everybody has glimpses of sanity, Rory. And even in this article that we're going to go through, there's a sentence here and there that actually makes good sense. There's an emphasis here and there that makes good sense. But as far as, you know what Robert Gates is? This is a guy who operates, who possibly, sits at the opposite pole, from myself in this channel in terms of respect and position. I am as far outside of the U.S. foreign policy mainstream as it is possible to be, and this man is at the absolute center, one of the most respected.
Because you haven't had your, 60 minutes yet?
Yeah, sure. He's one of the most respected and most influential figures in American foreign policy. And written before the Gaza-Israel thing, but I, of course, was reading it in the context of the wreckage that is inflicting upon us. Robert Gates, one of the most respected and influential figures in American foreign policy, decided to write an article called "The Dysfunctional Superpower" in the November-December 2023 issue of Foreign Affairs. I think it's probably worth talking a little bit about what foreign affairs is, how important it is.
And some ways to get past paywalls on websites.
Yes. Well, what's nice about foreign affairs is it's not a news organization. It is not. I get this all year, and I'm beyond the paywall for a cost of a single month of Bloomberg online news. It's incredibly cheap because the point of this is propaganda. That is the point of... So Foreign Affairs is the publication of the Council on Foreign Relations, which goes back about 100 years, or maybe it's about 120 years now. And it is part of sort of the permanent government, the deep state, the blob.
Like the Pentagon News, essentially?
Not really, no. So this is... Okay. It's traditionally got a lot more influence from U.S. corporations. I think as U.S. corporations, like all Americans, have become less and less interested in foreign affairs, in foreign policy generally, I think the Council on Foreign Relations has become more of a plaything of Gulf monarchs, certainly the Israeli government to some degree, but vastly more importance, U.S. weapons companies. But despite that, foreign affairs has retained its pole position. So Robert Gates is kind of bummed, probably, because he got bumped out of the, you know, normally if Robert Gates had decided to write, commit an intervention of this note, it would be on the cover. But he got bumped by the actual national security advisor of the United States, Jake Sullivan. So that's the kind of outlet that Foreign Affairs is. There are occasionally great articles in Foreign Affairs. They do let some dissident figures, intelligent figures write in foreign affairs. But typically, I mean, in this issue, you've got, so who's paying for all this? The reason foreign affairs is so cheap and so influential, you have on the first page a big ad from Palantir, which is Peter Thiel's sort of tech AI, have you. It used to be for years, it was always Boeing or Raytheon, but Palantir is, you know, now Silicon Valley is part of the military-industrial complex too.
For AI swarm drones, which sounds exciting.
Yeah, that's Palantir. Aren't they great?
So 22nd U.S. Secretary of Defense from 2006 to 2011.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Bob Gates and how he is as influential as he is. So Robert Gates is actually, he's not from the idiot wing of the Republican foreign policy establishment. He's not.
The field nerds?
He's a success nerd. He is not.
A success nerd.
Well, he's old enough. The man is 80, and I do feel a little bad.
He actually looks quite well for 80.
Was it? I'm sure it's a current picture. He's not of the generation of H.W. Bush and James Baker, who actually did Baker as well, actually fight in World War II and then went on to wage and win the Cold War. But he was one of the underlings working with Bush and Baker. He was not some clown raping Central America for the benefit of right-wing donors. Those are the people who ended up forming George W. Bush's policy. But he was the head of the CIA in sort of at the end of the Cold War, and he was.
So we'll try not to fall out with him too much.
Indeed. He's a powerful, influential.
He can make people disappear, I'm sure.
He was the head of the CIA at the very end of the Cold War, but also throughout the 1980s was director of intelligence. I'm not entirely certain what that means beyond. Like my reading of Tom Clancy novels years ago. But I think there's some controversy over the fact that the CIA entirely missed the fact that the Soviet Union was falling apart. But that's that's just the military-industrial complex. The point of the military-industrial complex is to make people scared. And that's actually, I think that gets to what's going to be the title of this episode, which is the U.S. Empire's massive fraud.
Sorry, I've just remembered of a story about a woman in England thought they were being attacked because, you know, the paragliders were used in the attacks on Israel.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
So she seen a paraglider and thought that they were coming for England. So I think that's the level of fear they would desire.
Yes. And during the Cold War, you had the very real threat of the annihilation of the human species.
And some experts would tell us that we're even closer to that annihilation currently, but it's just not in the news anymore.
I would find that proposition hard to disagree with. But it's was not a monstrous fraud. It was probably just a minor fraud for the CIA to cover up the details of the Soviet disintegration, if that's what happened. But regardless, Gates is a member of sort of the classic adults in the room who won the Cold War, and then he moved off to be a university president after a job well done or what have you. After the nightmarish chaos that the Yahoos who stayed in Washington, D.C., created after Donald Rumsfeld, I believe, was Secretary of Defense for Bush from 2000 until 2006, and nobody disagrees that he made a tremendous hash of things. Robert Gates was the grand old man called out by the Bush administration. You know, one of Daddy's guys will save me. And that is largely through a great deal of, and this is the monstrous fraud part, through a great deal of media primping and outright lying and complete misunderstanding of what the surge in Iraq accomplished, or rather did not accomplish.
Because he's still very defensive of it. He seems to think it was a great thing to do.
Sure, it was a big win in Iraq. Don't pay any attention to what happened 5 years later when the Islamic State almost took over the entire country. And of course, the Afghanistan surge, which was also... So he became the Secretary of Defense, or Secretary of War, if we were a little more honest. And what makes him such a respected and influential figure is that he was appointed to clean up the mess in the last years of Bush. And then Obama, even though he was a lifelong Republican, Obama kept him on as Secretary of Defense for, I think, 3 years. And he, once again, he's incredibly savvy, got out before any of the catastrophes of the Obama administration came to fruition. So he got out in 2011, is my understanding. So he worked with Obama for 3 years. He's just seen as this massively bipartisan, lovely figure. His memoirs...
Although he did write a book, didn't they, where he was criticizing Obama?
Well, of course, he's a Republican. And we'll
but
get
Joe Biden's
bit...
the worst, apparently.
Is that what he said about?
Yeah.
Unfairly, I would argue, seen as a great success and a great bipartisan figure. So when Robert Gates wants to make an intervention, it's a really big deal. And how rude of Jake Sullivan to get in his way and take away his foreign affairs cover. I do have to say, though, that this Jake Sullivan thing, just we were talking about just sort of the fall of Biden. Jake Sullivan, the national security advisor, meant for this cover story to be a really, really big deal. I just got it last week. It would have been released online probably as Hamas was invading Israel. And it I haven't read this. I should read it at some point. But it does, and this was, I'm stealing from somebody on Twitter. I can't remember who pointed this out. It is the pull quote of all pull quotes that just sort of illustrates what foreign affairs is or how useful it is for analysis of the world, which is the Middle East is quieter than it has been for decades.
Wow.
Sorry. So that's probably actually all we need to know about the Jake Sullivan piece. Turning to the dysfunctional superpower, this article absolutely enraged me. The first paragraph of this article enraged me. And this is U.S. Empire's monstrous fraud. We're going to spend two episodes going through this article because, again, this is one of the most influential and respected figures in foreign policy. And I think what he's putting forward here is deeply, deeply fraudulent, because it is rooted.
Can you see this being used as a template for the next 10 years?
There's very little here, Rory, that isn't already. This is more a crystallization of the conventional wisdom in Washington, D.C.
The document's being laminated at this point.
Yes, this is a summation of the view of the world. Of Washington, D.C. at this point, and how nothing is Washington, D.C.'s fault. The world is getting so much more dangerous. You, the U.S. taxpayer, must absolutely be afraid. That's be very, very afraid and give us more money because we're the only way you're going to be safe.
And you're not allowed food stamps anymore. That's the big problem.
Yeah, the big problem is what little social safety net there is in the United States. That comes out in this article. And that's what got me probably the most, that just enraged me so much, is it's just the United States has been in charge for 100 years and becomes more and more powerful. Like our rivals become smaller and smaller and tinier and more laughable. You know, Putin is a shell. Russia is a shell of what it was 30 years ago or even 5 years ago. Hamas is a disgusting little terror group that the Israeli and U.S. governments have maintained in power for a decade or so because it's such a useful foil for them. It's like we're down to nothing. China's a real problem that these guys created. I'm not saying that it was bad to help China get rich. What was bad was to help China get rich and then spend 20 years antagonizing them. Telling them, you know, here, get rich in this rules-based order we have. By the way, none of these rules apply to us. And if you want to be a great power, you've got to prove that you can destroy countries the way we can. That's the reason the world is dangerous. And that's what's so pernicious about this, is this is a 20-page call to give more money to the Pentagon, to give more money to weapons of destruction. And I get it. Like, the world does look a little bit more dangerous. But what this article is, and what most of what's published in Foreign Affairs is an exercise in covering up why the world is more dangerous. Because the main reason the world is more dangerous is because the U.S. government has taken enormous sums of money from the U.S. taxpayer and used it to make the world worse.
But this the American military doesn't know what money they'll have when a certain agreement is made since the past, for the past 10 years. It was one of the really weird, like, it's like when the budget is done up, they don't know exactly what they're getting. And apparently this is really what's doing America down, some bizarre technicality no one's heard of.
Yeah, we'll get it as the article is. It's just it's fascinating the way that minor bureaucratic snafus get in the way. And I think it's important to think about what is the ideal idea of Washington, D.C. What is their platonic ideal of what a president should be doing? And the horrifying truth, Rory. The horrifying truth is that they still all think George W. Bush had the right ideas. Maybe he could have, you know, maybe he could have implemented things a little bit better. We've covered over and over again on this channel what a nightmarish set of catastrophes Barack Obama created through his aggression. His aggression in Syria, his aggression in Libya, his aggression against China, his aggression against Russia. The Washington, D.C. mode, what everybody believes, what I'm sure Robert Gates believes, he's too polite to say it in here, is that Barack Obama was a big wimp because he didn't send troops into Syria. He didn't go as hard as Bush did. And that's the thing. It's like, I think a lot of, you know, anybody writing in this episode, in this issue of Foreign Affairs, anybody in the U.S. foreign policy establishment will tell you that George W. Bush was a big failure. Obviously, he sucks. But they just desperately want every president to be George W. Bush. And that is a really, I think, a really horrifying thing to realize. And I think gives you a sense of again, this monstrous fraud that is being perpetrated on the American people. This idea that, you know, you need to be totally afraid of everybody else and not afraid of this foreign policy establishment that has freaking ruined the post-Cold War utopia.
Well, just we're seeing, I know it's very partisan, but just we're seeing a kind of kickback at the American military in America, but only if it's weapons going to Ukraine, even though Ukraine's currently costing America less than Afghanistan, but a lot of Republicans feel like they should still be in Afghanistan. So there's a strange, like, oh, think of all the money this could have been spent in America, but it's very specific. It doesn't seem to expand into other realms. It's like, we don't really need a lot of this equipment that could be spent in America.
Yeah, as if the Republicans are chomping at the bit to fund some inner city schools or something.
Yes, or some trains.
But that's a great dynamic to highlight, because so much of this just falls apart in partisan nonsense. The truth is, it's all a mess. It's all fraught. It's all screwed. Like, it's good to defend Ukraine, but Republicans and Democrats worked together over decades to put Ukraine in that position. And this myth that they're like, Trump came into power saying, like, you know, God damn it. Like, he didn't use the explicit terminology, but essentially what he was saying is that the military industrial complex has done us wrong. And the first thing, not the first thing he did, it took him a while to do it. But what he did was take the one thing that Obama did that might have extricated us from the power of the military industrial complex, the Iran nuclear deal, and ripped it to shreds because of partisan nonsense. And that's one of the great tools. There's nobody in the Republican or Democratic parties who's saying, actually, all of this is a bad idea. Because, you know, they take our desperate urge for sports teams and politics in the United States, and they say, oh, well, the Democrats want to support Ukraine and the Republicans want to support Israel, and we'll fight about the details of this. Meanwhile, I mean, if you took out all Ukraine and all Israel funding, honestly, if you took all of those out of the budget, our $1 trillion military budget every year, if you took all funding for that, even if you took everything in the Middle East and everything for Ukraine just out of the budget entirely, our $1 trillion military budget would go down to $800 billion a year. Not even
insane.
Actually. That's an overestimate because it's not like if that money was taken away from Ukraine or taken away from Israel, it's not like the Pentagon had let it go. Yeah. Of course, the money, we've talked before about how when I moved to Washington, D.C. in 2003, it was kind of a bit of a backwater, and dealing with a lot of horrific sort of underinvestment and urban blight issues. And then by the time I left in 2011, after a solid decade of money for Afghanistan, it was just awash in yoga studios and brand new neighborhoods. Yeah, brand new neighborhoods filled with restaurants for people with grad degrees who wanted to work for the military industrial complex. So let's get into it, shall we? I mean, okay. So, you know, remember we're talking about this monstrous fraud. So these are the first sentences from the most respected and influential man probably in U.S. foreign policy. The United States now confronts graver threats to its security than it has in decades, perhaps ever. We're in more danger, Rory, than we have ever been.
Yes. Not World War II, not when Britain invaded or burnt down the White House.
Not the Soviet Union, you know, not like, not Germany and Japan. No, it's the great, perhaps ever. This is, I mean, that, just like that sentence. Like, I knew I wanted to do like a tear apart this article. And after reading that first sentence, I couldn't make it past the first paragraph for 2 weeks. It was so enraging. So the United States now confronts, this is the most respected and influential man in U.S. foreign policy. And he's saying that this is the most danger the United States has been in ever. Never before has it faced four allied antagonists at the same time.
That aren't Russia, really allied.
Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran, whose collective nuclear arsenal could within a few years,
They should have, you know, the little
double the size of our own.
It needs those little stars that say like exaggeration here.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, this sentence will take us 20 minutes to unpack. There's a reason we're doing this over to, okay.
North Korea, a country where starving people keep washing up on Japan, is a big threat to America.
Yeah. Iran, where like Iran has been so comprehensively encircled and debilitated by U.S. sanctions, U.S. assassinations. It is a plaything of the United States that has again desperately wanted peace with the United States since the 1990s, inviting U.S. oil companies in the 1990s, conquering Afghanistan with us in the aftermath of 9/11. So yes, Iran is an enemy of the United States because we have consciously maintained it as such for decades. North Korea, as you said, literally, its people are starving to death and washing up on shores across the Pacific. It is laughable. Russia and China are antagonists because we have antagonized them. Because this guy and the other people who have sat in the office of the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, the presidency, and thousands of functionaries below them have worked so goddamn hard to turn Russia and China into rivals. Allied, as you flagged. Like, they're not allies. No. They don't have any kind of, I guess there's this the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that's not like a thing. That's like BRICS, like allied, like.
Yeah. Like when you consider Russia's joke version of NATO, when Armenia called for help, they got nothing. So considering how vague this coalition is, it's like, yeah, they're not going to help anyone.
they have been, you know, Iran has been sending drones to Russia. I believe Russia is buying missiles or what have you. There are connections between these, and North Korea is definitely providing artillery. I think artillery rounds to Russia. That's a recent news story. They are aligned. They are thrown together. Countries that have very little in common and actually have great, great basis for antagonism. They are thrown together by U.S. aggression because the United States consciously has thrown them together. This guy's boss, George W. Bush, 21 years ago, tried to make this seem like a real thing, this sort of axis of evil. Gates doesn't use axis of evil, but Mitch McConnell has started talking about an axis of evil again.
Pivot of bad, what about that?
A pivot of bad. That does sound a little bit better. But it's just so goddamn frustrating. Okay, we've made it to the third line, and I think it's really key, and gets to what the emphasis of this entire article is: spend more money on weapons, spend less money on Social Security, spend less money on Medicare, spend less money on the U.S. public, because we got to go out there and make these wars. It is not a mistake. It is not a random thing that he starts talking about the nuclear arsenal in the third line. Robert Gates is a member of the military-industrial complex, and what he desperately wants is more nuclear modernization. He wants more money put into our nuclear weapons. He does actually talk a little bit at the end about, oh, public diplomacies would be an important thing to do, but he wants more money for Washington, D.C. And that's fundamentally what the nuclear arsenal is. It's more money for contractors. It's more money for executives. It builds more mansions because it's tremendously complex stuff. This isn't even the good old military-industrial complex. That actually, the good old military-industrial complex seems to be what we need. But did you actually see anything in this article talking about artillery rounds?
Well, nothing about jobs in all the states.
There's nothing in here about how humiliating it is that a year and a half into our proxy war between Ukraine and Russia, Ukraine is running out of artillery rounds as badly as Russia, the country that is like, what, a 30th of the GDP of the US and the EU together?
It's roughly the GDP of Spain, I think.
Yeah, that's a real humiliation. That's a real need. We really need to build artillery, factories that build artillery shells. That's actually something we need. That's a demonstrated serious gap in war fighting that we're going to need if Robert Gates can start the war he wants with China over Taiwan. If Robert Gates, you know, for the war in Ukraine that folks got, that Washington, D.C. wanted and got, for Israel's wiping out of Gaza. We need artillery shells desperately, desperately, desperately. But that's not what he talks about in the third line here. Because, you know, artillery shells, you'd actually have to build a factory. You'd actually have to give jobs to people. It would actually provide useful war material. What he's interested in is incredibly complex, incredibly difficult things that provide money for executives and engineers. And that's what nuclear modernization means.
But it's also, there's no need for it. Like, America can destroy all these nations, no problem.
Yes. Fundamentally, nuclear modernization is, and that's his third line, is like a truly, like, everything has failed. Everything has failed, and we're going to, what's extraordinary is, like, so we're going to nuke China over Taiwan? One of the most horrifying things I saw was that Admiral James Stavridis, who's, I think to his credit, isn't just a former general who's you know, cleaning up, taking money from Gulf countries and defense contractors. He's actually trying to be a public intellectual. I think he was a former NATO Supreme Commander. He was an admiral in the Navy. And he wrote a book where the United States nukes China multiple times over Taiwan. What? Think about how evil that is to be like, our proxy of 20 million Chinese people couldn't stand up to 1.5 billion. So I guess we're going to nuke Shanghai. That goes too far. I don't think Robert Gates wants to nuke Shanghai over Taiwan. I think, but putting this nuclear arsenal in the first paragraph, in the third line, emphasizes what he's concerned about. He's not concerned about actually fighting the wars better. He's concerned about spinning the money better. To be clear, like, we have all the nukes we would ever need to murder the world multiple times over.
Because I heard a statistic that Britain, which has about 200 nukes, has enough to take out Russia. So
yeah.
If America has how many thousand?
I think 6,000 or thereabouts. But there's a distinction between active warheads and I'm not too familiar with. I do know that, you know, Russia and the United States both have enough forces ready to go to murder the whole world within 15 minutes. Now, to be clear, I do believe there's some scope for making sure these tremendously complicated machines of death like are operating okay and aren't going to just explode on the pad or, you know, that sort of thing. They do need to be modernized or what have you. But what's freaking extraordinary about this is he doesn't mention that there's already a $1 trillion program of nuclear modernization ongoing in the United States.
But yeah, he makes it out like you haven't spent money on nukes in like 20 years.
We are literally spending $100 billion a year for the next 10 years. And you know what? Like, I probably half of that shouldn't happen in this new disgusting platforms. But, you know, I would say that we should totally spend like $500 billion on nuclear modernization over the next 50 years, you know, to make
sure
that's
the intro sorted. I'll just clip that. Just you saying that.
like just, well, I'm happy to hear that. Just so they don't, you know, explode on the pad or like, you know, fall apart. Like, you know, as long as Russia has nukes and China has nukes, the United States has to have nukes. But like just on the third line, just ignoring, you know, like we're thinking about nukes and nowhere in here does he mention artillery. Nowhere in here does he mention the fact that we are pouring. That's the math, right? $100 billion a year for the next 10 years into modernizing our nuclear. $100 billion. So we're spending more, vastly more than we're spending to support Ukraine into building new nuclear platforms every year.
But that could be $200 billion, Rob. Like, you need to think outside the box.
Yeah, that's what he's arguing here. That's what the most respected and influential guy in U.S. foreign policy is arguing, that the $1 trillion we're spending, and with this, I think for sure, with this supplementary bill for Ukraine and Israel, we will be spending $1 trillion on the U.S. military this year. It's such an obscene amount of money for nothing.
But what about the Korean War?
Not since the Korean War has the United States had to contend with powerful military rivals in both Europe and Asia. I mean, you know, I spent a lot of time belittling the Soviet Union, but like the whole Cold War, you had China and the Soviet Union, and they weren't enemies until the end of the 1960s. So like, anyway, yeah. But I mean, why would anybody working in foreign policy have any sense of history? In fact, having any sense of history working professionally in U.S. foreign policy is actually a detriment. No one alive can remember, and no one alive can remember a time when an adversary had as much scientific, technological, and military power as China today. I mean, that's actually not entirely wrong.
Oh yeah, China, asterisk.
Yeah,
because he makes it out like ever, you know, in anyone's life, no one's ever challenged America since this, and you're like, yeah, there has been in a lifetime, and then it goes asterisk, China.
Well, I mean, China is absolutely a large challenger, but China is a large challenger because these guys have spent 20 years antagonizing China. It's really like the opportunity we had in the 1990s was we can allow China to get rich. We can allow India to get rich. We can, within a context of a post-Cold War.
But also in a way that, you know, benefits America as well.
Of course.
You know, China wasn't getting richer at America's expense. Obviously, you could argue American workers, but American corporations may have made a killing out of it.
Of course. And that would have kept going. But like, and you know, just like my thought that I'm trying to finish there is that like, we could have allowed China to become massively rich and the U.S. to profit from it in the context of a post-Cold War settlement that was completely designed and run by the United States. And instead, we chose to go after Bush's axis of evil and wreck that and create a situation where, and this is the blind spot in Robert Gates and every other foreign policy. Like, I can point to a lot of specific things that the United States did to antagonize China and Russia specifically, but beyond that, and I think much more importantly and completely neglected, is what the United States did for the entire Bush and Obama administrations. We said, get rich within our global order. It's a rules-based liberal order. Oh, and yeah, any country we dislike, we're going to smash them into the ground. We are going to murder them. We are going to destroy them. We are going to, you know, step out of line, and we're going to just absolutely slaughter you.
Just with sanctions?
No, I mean, Iraq.
Libya. Oh, yeah, but what I mean is, like, you can destroy a country with only sanctions, and then we could go the extra mile.
Yeah, and crush you. Well, that's the thing. We could have just, I mean, I would argue that our sanctions weapons would have been infinitely more powerful if we hadn't destroyed Iraq, Syria, and Libya. Because like, but yeah, so like we basically, you know, we've talked about it before on this podcast, but you know, in 2011, so China and Russia both desperately tried for 20 years after the end of the Cold War to fit into our system. And we shat in their face over and over and over again, destroying Iraq, destroying the Middle East, destroying Syria, destroying Libya, after they gave us a UN resolution saying, yes, you can do something in Libya, but whatever you do, don't overthrow Gaddafi. And we just overthrew Gaddafi. Like, it's like we crushed the chances of a post-Cold War utopia. The United States did that. And yes, China is big and rich and now scary in some respects. I don't think anywhere near as scary as Gates wants to portray it as, because we have backed them into a corner. And we have demonstrated over and over and over again that we have nothing to offer other than violence and ruin to those who try to go their own way. That's what Gaddafi was. That's what Saddam Hussein was. That's what Assad still barely is. And it's just like, but like, nobody wants to acknowledge, just, oh no, just Russia and China just decided in the 2010s to be mean. Like, did you just sleep through the 2000s? Did you just sleep through the 9/11 war on terror, the destruction of Africa, the destruction of the Middle East? Did you just sleep through that? So anyway, back to, I feel like, yeah, this, I'm glad we've dedicated 2 hours to Robert Gates, because I think we've almost finished the first hour.
With the second paragraph?
Yes, it's on to the second paragraph of a couple hundred. the problem, however, is that at the very moment that events demand a strong and coherent response from the United States, the country cannot provide one. Its fractured political leadership has failed to convince enough Americans that developments in China and Russia matter. And you know why? Because they don't. Developments in Russia and China don't matter unless you've spent decades crafting U.S. proxies on the borders of Russia and China. Like, that didn't matter. That didn't have to happen. Like, this was a choice that the United States poured billions and billions and billions of dollars into. So, like, Taiwan and Ukraine, what happens to China and Russia in China and Russia matters very, very much to Taiwan and Ukraine. It does not matter to the United States at all. It just doesn't. And you know, like, it's interesting that the fractured, like, there are serious problems with partisanship in the United States, Rory. Don't let me undermine that at all. But the problem, the dysfunctional aspect of the superpower that Robert Gates identifies throughout this piece is not that that there's race relations issues, not that there's tremendous resentment over housing or healthcare or education or inequality. No, the problem for Robert Gates is that the Republicans and Democrats are ineffectively selling weapons.
Yeah,
they're not doing
they
a good enough
do
job.
Everything the Pentagon wants.
Yeah, they're not participating in the military-industrial complex's monstrous fraud to the extent that Robert Gates would like them to.
I remember him talking about Afghanistan. He was talking about what a massive threat it was, but he talked about it like it was a regime, but he couldn't name one person. And then he talked about the UN helping with that famine thing. Yeah. And you're like, yeah, this is a country with a famine that's just had a horrendous earthquake. And this is your big boogeyman. It's just, it's horrendous how he just doesn't really consider the necessities of life. But it's all just about, yeah, guns and nukes. We need more money for them.
We need more money for guns. We need more money for wounds. It's just, it is extremely frustrating. And the thing is, we actually have pretty extreme bipartisanship. The one thing that Republicans and Democrats have agreed upon very consistently over the past two decades is giving the Pentagon whatever it wants. Look at how there, I don't think there's a single Democrat in the Senate. There are some Democrats in the House who want to pressure Israel into a ceasefire in Gaza, but there aren't any Democrats in the Senate, and there's not a single Republican. There's an interesting dynamic that was identified, is that the greatest, and Biden, I'm not sure if he's gotten it through yet or not, but Biden is trying to get a package of new funding for Israel and Ukraine through, and Mitch McConnell his big Republican enemy is his biggest ally in trying to get it through the Congress. So we've had incredible bipartisanship behind this enormous fraud, behind the least worthwhile spending of U.S. money. And Robert Gates just doesn't think it's enough. Thinks we should do more. Thinks we don't need to spend $1 trillion on nuclear weapons over the next 10 years. We need to spend $3 trillion.
And shut down the government because the debt ceiling can't be risen.
Oh, well, it's funny because he does actually complain about that. He does complain. He says, that's bad.
That's bad.
That's bad.
It's okay if it's spending it on weapons.
Yes, it's much better. Like he has two very small critiques for Republicans in here, but like he's not a partisan figure. He's not. He's a bipartisan figure because both of the parties are wholeheartedly behind. You know, they'll quibble about that 10% that 5 to 10% that's going to Israel and Ukraine, but the whole rest of it just gets signed off on year by year by year.
And I think to read the other paragraphs, you'll have to listen to the next episode.
Indeed.
Where Rob may get angrier.
It's entirely possible. It's entirely possible.
So we'll catch you next time.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is Rob O'Law, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire: What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.